How about I do the scripture reading here shortly? Hey, it's been good to be here. Thank you, Mike, for that singing, that song. Wow. You can't beat that. Love endures all things. Hey, thank you again for letting me be a part of Fortifying the Family Day. It's been a good day, and we need to finish well. Let me make sure all systems are go. I think so. It's been a good day. We need to finish well. We've been talking about factors that lead couples apart over time. I have a curiosity about couples who pledge their love for each other, and then over the years, they seem to grow apart. And you've all witnessed it, right? Over time. And so if we know what the factors are that lead couples apart over time, we can be more intentional about strategies to mitigate or to resist those tendencies and to foster a married life that honors God as couples seek a holy life together. Well, we have two more factors to talk about, so I invite your patience with that. They're important conversations. I don't know if I'm the only one that likes to be in control. You know, we could ask for a show of hands, like, do you like to be in control? But I'm going to just assume that most of you do. If you're a lot like me, I go to places like Home Depot and Walmart, and I have my shopping cart, and I go out to my parking spot, and I empty my cart into my car, and I look way down the aisle there, and there's a sign, you know it, that says it, please return cart to bin. Now, I don't know if it's just me and my temperament, but I look down the aisle, and I read that please return cart to bin, and I'm like, I don't think so. I'm like, really? I don't like people imposing behavior on me. Do you? Do you like somebody imposing behavior on you? I'm like, if you wanted me to return the cart to the bin, you should have put the bin closer to my car, right? And so, yeah, I just kind of resist people that impose behavior on me. I like to be in control. Or maybe you've done like me. You go to Walmart or something, and you've got your grocery cart, and you come up front there to check out, and you're coming up to the checkout about the same time somebody else is coming up. There's like eight lanes here, and you do a really quick calculation as to which lane you think would be moved the fastest, you can get through first, and you want to get there before the other person gets to that lane, right? And so you choose your lane, and you choose they choose their lane. And have you ever done this? You actually watch them as you go through to see if you get through before they get through, right? Like you had any control over it or had any say over it. You do that sort of thing, right? Well, perhaps the best example is driving behavior. I don't know if I should say too much about this or admit this, but have you ever been out on the interstate and, you know, speed limit 70 and you're already doing 72 and you're in the left-hand lane and there's a car in the right-hand lane and you're kind of approaching that car, you're already 2 miles over the speed limit, and sometimes there's a car comes flying up on your bumper. You ever had that happen to you? They kind of fly up on their bumper. And sometimes I look in my rearview mirror, and it's all I see is a hat, which normally signifies this is a lady driver who has a hat on. It looks like the hat's driving the car, you know. And she's right on my bumper and maybe flashes her lights a few times at me. You know what I mean? You're kind of imposing behavior on me. You want me to yield. You want me to get out of the way. I'm already 2 miles over the speed limit. And then you're going to ride right there on my bumper. Now, I hate to admit it. Maybe I'm the only one in this audience. But I've been known to do a few things in that moment. It's like, okay, they come up on your bumper. right on your bumper. And I'm like, okay, you want to play that game? You want a piece of my bumper, huh? Have you ever done this? Have you like hit your brakes kind of hard and watched the front end of their car bite the pavement, trying not to come in the back of you? Maybe even sparks fly because their bumper is hitting the pavement because they're about to come in the back of you. Or maybe you've done this. Have you ever done this? It's like, okay, they're flashing their lights. Eventually, I've got to what? Give way. So I speed up. I give them some hope. I speed up a little bit, and I gradually get past this car on the right. I know I've got to yield at some point, right? And so they're still riding right there on my bumper, and I'm being resistant. I don't like you imposing behavior on me. And so you eventually have to move over. Have you ever done this? You go to move over, and they're just itching to come through. You can see it. They're still right there on your bumper. You go to move over, and when you cross over the center line, you just pause. You're halfway in their lane, and you just pause just to communicate to them that you're still in control, and you will yield only when you're ready to yield, and then eventually you move on over, and they go, have you ever done that? Am I the only person that does that sort of thing? Hey, I'm young people, I'm not recommending that kind of behavior. I had one brother say to me one time, says, yeah, that happened to me. I was like in six-lane traffic, like three lanes here and three lanes over there. It was bumper to bumper. Somebody was riding right on my bumper and just irritated me, trying to impose their will, their way on me. And he said, we all got stopped by a red light, like six lanes of traffic got stopped. This person right behind me, he says, I got out and raised my hood. You have to think about that in a moment, right? Huh? He got out. They weren't going anywhere until he said they could go somewhere. He got out and raised his hood. What are we talking about? We're talking about the control factor. Love is diminished. One of my favorite quotes by Ronald Sampson. To the extent that power is the prevailing force or focus in a relationship, whether between a husband and wife or parent and child, between friends or between colleagues, watch this, to that extent, love is diminished. Say it again. To the extent that power becomes the focus, the prevailing force in any relationship, husband, wife, parent, child, among colleagues, among elders and ministers, to that extent, love is diminished. If I were to do a little research, I go out here and I ask parents, when you think of raising your children, what time in raising your children did you feel or experience the least amount of love from your children? And more often than not, they will say, oh, the teenage years. Guess what? I go over here to teenagers and I'm like, hey, teens, would you tell me what time it was in your raising? Or maybe after they've graduated from teens. Looking back on it, the time of your raising where you felt the least lovable, or the least love from your parents. When was it? They almost always say the teen years. And you know it, don't you? What's the central issue of the teen years? Who's in charge? Who's in control? The issue of power and power dynamics. Hey, let me pause right here and give a little caution. As I was thinking about power and control, which is an element of all relationships, competition seems to be a kissing cousin of power and control. Competition, winning, seems to be closely related to power and control. And it occurred to me, I hadn't really thought about it much until this past weekend, last weekend, as I was thinking about this, that do you realize, I don't think there is anywhere in Scripture where we are encouraged to be competitive. I hear husbands and wives say, hey, I'm competitive. I'm the competitive one. And I'm like, well, I don't know if there's anywhere in Scripture that that's lifted up as a virtue that we should pursue. It's like competitiveness is a social construct. I mean, we live in a society and sports and all that of competition. Some of you are looking forward to that today. I get to watch competition. Well, guess what? If you're not too careful, you'll buy into this notion of being competitive. And I'm here to tell you some of the ugliest marriages I have seen have been two competitive people who compete with one another. And I suggest to you that your wife or your husband should be the last person you compete with. So perhaps I would suggest that basketball or something like that, maybe the football thing, is okay, but I'm here to suggest you don't need to be in competition with your spouse. And I don't know if she realized it at the time, but we were with a group last weekend, and I heard Wanda say, Steve's not very competitive. And I took that as a compliment because you would have also heard her say, when we were first married, Steve always had to what? Win. Oh, yeah. I've learned not to be in competition with my spouse. So what brick would lead us to deal with this notion of power and control in our relationships? And I'm going to suggest to you, it's the brick of mutual submission. Oh, how do we define the term first? Submission. To commit something to the consideration or judgment of another. To yield to the opinion of another. Can I commit this to your judgment, to your consideration? Can I yield to your opinion? Well, what does God have to say about that? What would God want us to know about that? I like to look over to Ephesians 5, and we will abbreviate these comments, Ephesians 5, 21 through 25. Notice it begins, verse 21, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. I don't know if we pause and spend enough time there. Verse 21 says very simply, there is nothing gender specific about submission. The way of Christ is a way of having a submissive spirit about you. You submit one to the other out of reverence for Christ. He goes on to say, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands as you do unto the Lord. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Now, let's pause and look at that, maybe not get too deep into the theology of it, but it says, hey, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands, right? Now, I don't know, that might seem like a difficult charge. Wives, submit yourself to your husbands. But it also occurred to me, if you look at that passage, he's got a pretty strong charge to men as well. You know, wives, you may think that's a difficult thing that you would submit yourself to your husband. That, yes, I do think he's calling men to be spiritual leaders. And there's probably some requisite authority that goes along with that, right? And so women may say, well, that's a hard charge to submit ourselves to our husbands. Well, look at what he says to the husbands. It sounds pretty hard for them, too. Look. Husbands, love your wives, what? Just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Men, what's your charge? Your charge is to love her, what? Just as Christ loved. Well, that's a pretty heavy charge too. He's saying, men, you're supposed to love the way Christ loved. Well, that's a pretty challenging instruction. So we would ask, but what does that mean? What's that mean? Husbands, love your wives just as. So I want to take you over to John chapter 13. That'll be our scripture reading here. And I really believe to understand Ephesians 5 and what's being taught about mutual submission, you need to go to John chapter 13. It's become one of my favorite passages. Now watch this. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave the world and to go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. What's he about to do? I'm going to show you the full extent of my love. Or some translations would say something like, I'm going to show you how to love. Isn't that pretty cool? Jesus says, I'm going to show you how to love one another. Now watch. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Hey, watch this. Jesus is going to show you how to love the unlovable. Didn't we talk about that earlier? How do you love the unlovable? How do you forgive the unforgivable? Jesus is going to show you how to love the unlovable here. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. Let me pause there a moment. I find it rather interesting that in a chapter where he says, I'm going to teach you how to love one another, the conversation moves to power. Aren't you intrigued by that? I thought you were going to teach us about love. And now you're talking about power. It says Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his what? His power. I wonder if it's because there are power dynamics in any relationship, including your marriage. Maybe that's why the conversation shifts to power. Jesus knew that God had put all power under him, and that all things were put under his power. I would suggest to you, in this instance, he's talking about positional power. Like, he knows his position. As the Son of God, all things have been put under my power. Now, there's some characteristics that I would suggest that go along with positional power. They tend to be things like authoritative, being a leader, being in control, being decisive, being assertive, at times maybe even being aggressive. And these are the kind of characteristics we often witness in many workplaces, right? Hey, if you're a highway patrolman and you pull somebody over out here at 2:00 in the morning, you best have some positional power about you. You best be a person who can be authoritative, decisive, assertive, and at times a little bit aggressive, right? And I would say, you say, well, did Jesus have positional power? Well, we could go and look more at cleansing the temple, and you would see him in a role where he exercised positional power and authority and assertiveness and even aggressiveness in the face of sinfulness. But watch, he's talking about positional power. And then it goes on, he says, after that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Notice, Peter understood positional power. Lord, which means what? Ruler? Master, are you going to wash my feet? Jesus replied, you do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand. No, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet. Peter understood positional power. You are the Son of God. You are in a position of authority. It is, watch this, your right for me to wash your feet, not my right for you to wash my feet. Peter got it. He understood positional power. And watch this, one of my favorite of all scripture. We don't give enough attention to it. Look at what Jesus said to Peter. Jesus answered, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. That's a pretty strong statement if you stop and think about it. He says, Peter, I'm teaching you a different kind of power. I'm teaching you a personal power. How is it that you capture the heart of someone? How is it that you embrace the life of someone to influence them, to change them? A personal power. Unless I wash you, you have no part with me. Those are strong words. He's saying, Peter, if you don't understand what I'm teaching you right now, don't even claim to be my disciple. He's saying, if you don't understand what I'm teaching you in this moment, don't even claim to be a Christian. It's pretty strong language. And I say it to you as to our marriages. Unless I wash you, you have no part with me. He goes on and says, you call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. When will we have stronger marriages? When we have husbands and wives who have learned to wash feet. When will we have stronger churches? When we have elders and ministers who have learned to wash one another's feet. A brief story. Wanda and I are very close to our son, Alan, and daughter-in-law, Rachel. Very close. We taught together for 4 or 5 years. They were in our home almost on a daily basis. And due to change in circumstance, they decided they were going to go away to Cookson Hills Ministries in Oklahoma and become house parents. Now, my son has a PhD in family studies. The requisite for the job description was a high school education. And they came to us and they said, we want to minister together. And we're going to take our 3 grandchildren to Cookson. And we're going to put 7 disadvantaged young people in our family. And we're going to try to influence their lives. Wanda and I were kind of somewhat disturbed by that. We were obviously concerned about the observational learning of our grandchildren, what they might would be witnessing there with these disadvantaged youth and what kind of influence it might have in their lives. We tried to talk to Alan and Rachel in a very tactful way, expressing some things for them to consider and perhaps some of our concerns. We really did try to do that in the right way. But I assure you this, we got bent sideways. And we were close to them, and they were close to us, and we got where we couldn't hardly talk. Now, I remember just before they were moving and such, we were at a basketball game one Saturday, and I'm sitting there watching my grandchildren, and Rachel and Alan and Wanda are sitting next to me, and we watched this basketball game hardly saying a word to one another. Because as much as we had tried to be tactful about it to them, it still sounded like we were trying to impose our will on them, perhaps. And they were hurt, and we were hurt, and we were not speaking to one another. The basketball game was over, and my son Alan says, Dad, we need to talk. And I knew we did. I knew exactly what he was saying. Well, guess what? We had already tried several times before to talk. I said, we'll go home. We'll be right over. And Wanda and I went home, and we were like, hey, what do we say? We've already tried several times, and it hasn't gone very well. What do we say? And I'm like, Wanda, we don't need to say anything. We need to wash feet. We went over there, and the moment came where we were going to try to talk, and I asked Alan and Rachel if they would sit in a chair, and we had brought our bucket into their garage. We went out and got the bucket in the garage and filled it with water. And I can remember kneeling washing Alan's feet. Wanda washing Rachel's feet. While we read the scripture, blessed is the feet of those who take the gospel. And we said to them, you have our blessing to take the gospel to disadvantaged youth. And we will trust you and the Lord to take care of the souls of our grandchildren. And we said no more. From that day, they have known they have our blessing. So, I suggest to you, when it comes right down to it, there are only two words a man has to remember about leading his wife, just as. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved his church and gave himself up for her. Jesus demonstrated his personal power by washing his disciples' feet. That's submission. Men, how do you lead your family in spiritual ways? You lead them just as. Means that you lead in the washing of feet. You lead in the serving of others. You lead in the honoring of your spouse. You lead in sacrificial love, in giving in compromising. You lead in your obedience to God. You lead in spiritual development. You lead in being willing to be the first to say, I was wrong. You lead in your willingness to say, I am sorry. You love just as. You know, when I've done some counseling in church settings, I have seldom had a wife say to me, I don't like the way he's controlling and domineering. Now hear me say, I've heard that message. But far more often I've heard wives say, I wish he would lead. I wish he would decide. I wish he would be a compass for our family. I wish he would speak up. I wish he would give direction. I wish he would be spiritually disciplined in our marriage. I hear that message far more than I hear he's controlling, domineering, and such. Okay, I know you're ready. Let me wrap up with the faith factor. It's not enough. I alluded to this earlier. I had a client one time who said, hey, talking about her husband, she said, I just want to be the center of his world. Doesn't it almost sound romantic? I just want to be the center of his world. Being a good therapist and knowing this particular client, I looked at her and I said to both of them, I said, I think what you mean is you want his world to revolve around you. I think that's what you're really saying. And I knew it wasn't going to happen in their relationship. And I knew that in marriage, that your marriage never was intended to be enough. Your marriage never was intended to make you complete, to be your ultimate fulfillment. It's not enough. Can't be. Never will be. Because God didn't intend it to be your primary purpose in life. So the faith factor, it's not enough, would suggest a greater purpose in our marriage. Seeing our marriage as part of something bigger, as part of something greater, and I've already alluded to it earlier, right? The something greater is we're trying to get to heaven. And I want to help Wanda get to heaven. And Wanda help me get to heaven. We're trying to make a holy life together. And so I suggest to you that your spouse will likely do more than anyone to either help or hinder your walk with God. Conversely, you will likely do more than anyone to either help or hinder your walk with God. So, brick 11 here, my numbers are right, is spiritual intimacy. Now, I've tried to be open and honest with you from my own life experience. And I'm going to suggest to you that spiritual intimacy I'm talking about here has been difficult for me over the years. I wasn't raised in that way necessarily. It didn't come naturally to me, and I suspect for some in this audience, some of the men of this audience, and I'm going to speak to the men a bit here, is it doesn't come readily to you, some of you either. Maybe it does, but probably not for all of you. What I'm trying to suggest is written about by Gordon MacDonald. Look at what he says. Now, he's a minister, preacher. He's all about tending to the spiritual needs of other people, right? And watch what he says. He says, this long period of involvement in spiritual leadership would lead one to believe that it must be the same in my own home, that I have always found it easy to lead my family through the exercises of worship, devotion, and prayer. But nothing of the sort has been true. Just because one can do these things in public is no guarantee that they can be done as easily in private. What he's talking about is a disconnect. He's saying when I'm with a congregation ministering to a large group of people, I connect with them in spiritual ways. And then when I go home, I feel disconnected with my own wife and family. It's like, other than the ceremonial prayers at meals and such, I very seldom lead in spiritual ways. And you know what? I think I have an idea what he's talking about. You see, a student can walk into my office and can share a problem or difficulty in their life, and it's real easy for me to say to them, hey, would you like to pray about that? And I will pray with them, and I will hold that up in prayer. And yet, when I go home, there will be those moments when I know that I need to show some leadership and say, we need to pray about that. And I can look back in my past and times, plenty of times when I just stayed silent. It's like, hey, what's the disconnect? Well, Gordon MacDonald helps us with it a bit, I think. Look at what he says here. In ways that I'm not sure I'm smart enough to explain or understand, it is hard to, quote, pastor, shepherd, someone you make love to, argue with about money, the kids, or the calendar. Pastoring or shepherding, the person who sees your dirty underwear, has been there when you hit your thumb with a hammer, and when you have thrown up in the toilet, is not an easy matter. And I think I know exactly what he's talking about. You see, Wanda knows me in a different way than that student. She knows my hypocrisies. She knows me warts and all. She knows my failures. She knows my inconsistencies. And it makes for a really awkward moment for me to try to lead in spiritual things when you've seen the worst side of me. And so consequently, we men, if we're not careful, we will retreat from spiritual intimacy with our wives. MacDonald goes on to say, your wife and mine want to know where we're at as we navigate through life at the deep spiritual levels. Are we in touch with God, or are we prepared to offer the kind of leadership that helps them to know God? Watch this. Or must they go it alone? So in particular, I want to challenge our men about something that I was not good at for a long time. And God's still molding and shaping me and calling me to grow in it. And that's spiritual intimacy with my wife. Now let me suggest some things. And I am somewhat talking to men here at the moment. Let me suggest some things that will cause men to retreat from spiritual intimacy with their wives. I'm talking about at home. I'm not talking about in a setting like this. Why is it that men find it so difficult to lead in a very personal and spiritual way in their private life with their wife? I'm going to give you a few reasons. At the top of my list, for me, my personal reflection, is we men will retreat when we believe that we are not the man our wife and our children believe us to be. You see, most every man has this kind of nagging inner voice where they acknowledge that they're not quite the man their wife thinks they are, or they're not quite the man that their son believes them to be. We will retreat from spiritual intimacy when we struggle with showing dependency on God, when we've got to always be in control. How about this one? We will retreat from spiritual intimacy when there's ongoing conflict in our marriage. You see, it's kind of hard to duke it out in the afternoon and then say, let me lead you in prayer shortly after. Now, you might be good at that. I'm just saying, I wasn't very good at that. That inconsistency, when I'm disappointed in my own behavior, when we have this ongoing conflict in our relationship, I will retreat from spiritual things. And then the big one, the really big one, that all men know, is that you will retreat from leading your family in spiritual ways when there is secret sin in your life. See, the hypocrisy of it will be too great. When you see your own hypocrisy and their secret sin in your life, you will back away from being a spiritual leader in your own home. Well, let me draw this to a close. It's been good to be with you today. And this is my prayer for you as we close our time together. May you rejoice in the wife, the husband of your youth. May you ever be captivated by his or her love. If we can help anyone today, we invite you to come. Make your need known while we stand and sing.